Hi, my name is John Kim. I'm a therapist who went through his own rebirth many years ago, and I've been documenting my journey ever since, sharing my life lessons and revelations. I believe in casual over clinical, with you instead of at you. I come unrehearsed on purpose because self-help doesn't have to be so complicated. All right, so Dr. Nicole LaPera, thank you so much for coming here. I thought you lived in Venice. You live in Arizona now. The first time we've met, I feel a kinship to you because I consider you an OG. And I remember, like, when was Instagram invented? No, seriously, like 2010? 2012. So I was on Tumblr 2010, got on Instagram, I don't know, 2013. And I feel like there was a few of us, you definitely one, who were in kind of a 90s Apple ad way weirdo. You know what I'm saying? Yeah, like, yes. I felt like an outcast. Oh, yeah, and I was inappropriate, and I didn't like the conventional. I didn't like tucking my shirt in, and I felt very alone. So when I went to therapy school, it was mostly women, no Koreans. And so, you know, this guy with a broken heart who liked motorcycles and CrossFit, on Instagram or on Tumblr, I just felt like, oh, this is, there's no one like me. And so one of the things I felt when I met you was, oh, there's like this whole, there's other people coming out, and you have more letters after your name. So you're more quote unquote professional, but you were really showing yourself and you were talking about things and doing things in a way at that time I thought was just courageous and off center. You know what I'm saying? Coloring outside the lines. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I'm very much appreciating you say that, John. I think many thoughts I'm having, I'm giggling at the kind of short comment because I spent a lot of time, especially in my early graduate training, feeling very other in my program for many different reasons. Even just the fact that I had to have a separate job to pay for my program, and most of the people in my program, you know, were working in labs. So I was the weird girl who would just kind of float in and out of classes. And I heard a lot of commentary from my teachers about how I dressed, that I never looked professional enough. Or even at one time, I got told I didn't look feminine enough to, you know, be the therapist in the room. And I spent a lot of time feeling outside. And I think our field did a good job at convincing ourselves to some extent that it was important to water down our humanity. And I did that. And I did that. I also smiled when you referenced the letters after my name. I loved me some letters at a time because I truly believe that that was a reflection of my Philadelphia.
With the East Coast, I feel like they put so much weight on academic, you know, like as opposed to the West Coast where it's more like who you know. But from the East Coast, I mean, you know, Vanessa's from New York and it's all about like the letters after your name, you know.
Letters, the name, the success. I didn't even just see that. I think culturally, it's interesting to think about though. I think the East, Northeast might have a bit more of that kind of rat race mentality in terms of achievement with all of the cities, though I also felt that very strongly in my family of origin for very well-intentioned reasons. I think this is what can be confusing for some of us. Messages I got were always around financial security and, you know, wanting my parents very directly, wanting me to have better and more and be happier and be more stable and secure than they were at one point in their life. And a lot of the decisions and messages I was given was what they believed, and I think reflected by society, was the pathway to that, which was through academic success, letters after the name, certain types of professional career paths versus others not being as appealing. So I very much, for a long time, near exhausted myself.
Dream to have a private practice? Like, why did you become...
It's interesting because I went through stages. So as long as I can remember, I was very fascinated with people. I wanted to always understand myself, understand other people. And that interest very quickly then led me into, you know, young adult books on psychology and then wanting to be a psychologist. And I spent some time going back and forth learning that the psychology degree was what is called scientist practitioner. So I could be one of two things. I could be the therapist in the room or I could be the scientist who researched. And if I'm being honest, I loved both. I loved the scientific research side of things. That was the job that I had while I was in grad school. I was a research coordinator at an institute for individuals with intellectual and developmental disabilities. So I loved studying, researching, learning.
That's more PhD than PsyD.
That's more. So that's why I went for the PhD, because I wanted to have options. I wanted to keep all my doors open so I could do anything I wanted. But then there was a part of me that absolutely liked the idea of working one-on-one with people, of being able to directly impact and service, which then having the practice was intuitively as opposed to. And this was an interesting part, honestly, too, in my journey where I felt othered when it got time for pre and postdoc internship. So once you train clinically and do all of the coursework within the school structure, you have to get a certain amount of hours where you're supervised under a licensed therapist before you can sit for your license. And it happens to be about 1 year before you get your official degree and then 1 year after you get your official degree. And I'm sharing that because school programs are ranked based on the percentage of students that rank in certain accredited internship sites, which all happen to be in inpatient or hospital settings. So there was a lot of pressure at my time because schools want to be ranked highly, so much so that some programs, neighboring programs in New York City, were telling their students, demanding that they had to apply to internship sites at each of the four quadrants of the United States. Simply, like, they had to move. They didn't care if they had a family, if they, like, New York City was their home base, if they got into this site. So saying that to say, I had to advocate. I had to meet with the director of my program because I was at a crossroads. I'm like, why would I do all of these training hours working in a setting where the treatment is categorically different than what I would be doing in my private practice? So after obviously advocating and the director finally seeing, you know, my side of things, had to grant me permission to do my training in a more private practice type model so that I could get the training that I thought would be more appropriate for the work I wanted to do.
Early days of Instagram, I was very activated by you, confession. And the reason why, you were the first to put as much information in a little square where you would need like a microscope to see, you know. And I remember like, what is this? Why is she doing this? No one's going to, like, read this because it's so tiny, I can't even see it. And, of course, that was uniquely you. I didn't see anyone else doing that. And now with 8 million followers on Instagram, crazy. Crazy. So your new book, I want to start with the title, How to Be the Love You Seek, right? So what I love about this title isn't how to find something or how to get someone, but it's almost, let's start with you, let's rewire yourself, and how to be a way where then you attract, you know? And so I think it's a great, I think it, you set the tone right away, right? And I also want to just kind of brag real quick. I know you do a lot of these interviews, you're flying around. I think very few actually read the book, through my experience, right? I read the whole thing, cover to cover. I'm dyslexic. I have ADD. It took me like 3 months, but I read the whole book. I'm just saying. Also, I wanted to point out we have a live audience today, and there's a floating microphone, and I wanted to keep this conversational. I don't like the word audience. These are also my friends. Very wise catalysts. We have coaches. We have a fitness person. We have and even if you're not in the business, you're a catalyst in some way. So whether you're a creative, an artist, nervous system therapist. So I just think it's going to be a great conversation if we make it a conversation instead of them out there in us, if you're okay with that. Yeah. So imagine we're just at a campfire. And so there's a floating microphone. And then if anyone wants to please interrupt me or, you know, whatever you want to do. I'm going to dive right into it because there's so much in that book and I want to get as much as I can in this hour. A lot of people are going to relate to this. The concept of absorbing mom stress. Look, already. Mom. That's it. It's the concept of absorbing mom stress. When they were pregnant with you and how that forms us as we enter this world. So before we're even out of the womb, how mom stress impacts us. Can you expand a little bit on this?
This is, I think, a beautiful place to start because even going back to, right, this idea that here I am writing a relationship book that isn't focused on saying the words correctly or asking, you know, for a particular need to be met. It begins with that foundational focus on ourselves. And why? Because so much of the habits that we carry into our current relationships, even from how we connect and relate to ourselves, beyond how we connect and relate to other people is really created and imprinted by those earliest environments, which does begin in utero. And this isn't language I would have had or the way I would have narrated my own journey even, you know, a decade ago. Not having awareness of the influence of environment, I wouldn't have really truly understand how much not only was my mom under stress near constantly, especially when she was pregnant with me, but more importantly, how much that stress impacted me. And especially, I mean, needless to say, not only do we begin development in someone else's body, I mean, we are born developmentally immature. Our brain and our nervous system continues to develop well into our 20s in reality. So all of these environments and the participants or the people that we're in relationship are really playing an incredibly foundational role, namely around the amount of stress in the environment and the individual's ability to regulate themselves through stress. Because again, in childhood, when we're dependent, we need the nervous system of calmly regulated adults around us to help us calm down when we're dysregulated or when we're upset. So for me, really understanding that my mom didn't have the resources available beginning at the first, you know, instance of my development allowed me to understand a lot of the struggles that I had had, from my own inability to deal with stress to my own struggle to recall memories from very early experiences, which is, I know, another aspect of my journey that a lot of people relate to. And really understanding that for me gave me then the keys to have the tools to begin to regulate myself in a new way, ultimately.
So nervous system work, I feel like it's pretty new in the scope of things, right? You're definitely one of the pioneers. To look at your life through the lens of nervous system, to kind of start there, to hang things on that, including relationships, I feel like it's so foreign to me as someone who grew up in the 80s and a very kind of parents always gone and always activated. It's like you're a different creature. It's not even like a tool. It's like a whole different way of living, you know? And so with love, why go in through that door? Why do you think that's important when it comes to love and relationships, starting with nervous system?
I think the nervous system and how our nervous system functions and ultimately becomes wired is, I mean, foundationally governs everything from how we think, what we think, how we navigate our emotions, which then extends to how we navigate emotional exchanges in relationships, to ultimately how safe and secure we feel to show up even in our self-expression, honoring our wants and our needs. I think it really is the foundation of all of that. And if we don't understand that, I think two things happen. One, we feel very shameful, as I think many of us struggle with these neurobiological patterns, if you will, of dysregulation and compensation or adaptation. I call them conditioned selves. And without kind of us understanding why it is that we're struggling, then we limit ourselves for that second piece, which is the tools to change, right? If we don't include our body and our nervous system in our transformation, our healing journey, whatever it is that we want to call it, a lot of us continue to feel stuck and really shameful about it over time.
What are the seven conditioned selves? Talk about in the book.
Yeah. So the conditioned selves are, again, what I call kind of these neurobiological ways of being that are wired in, not only to our mind, which include all of these different narratives, meanings, you know, stories about who we even believe ourselves to be. They're wired into how we show up in the world and ultimately all of these habitual reactions. And in childhood, in that state of dependency, when we need to rely on whatever version of caretaking was available to us, we will do the most adaptive thing to ensure our survival, which is we will begin to modify ourselves, right? We will be so attuned to the environment around us, and we will begin to determine simply what's acceptable and what's not acceptable. And before we know it, what some of us begin to do is we become, right, the person that we need it to be, or this self in our relationship, because in our earliest moments, that was what kept us safe. Right. If we had to be a little less dramatic, or if we had to be a little more in tune or in care in the caretaker model of, or in the caretaker conditioned self of someone else, if that ensured us avoiding an explosion or us, you know, being what someone else needed. So ensuring our connection to that person through that dynamic, we'll continue to sacrifice ourselves in service of the relationship. So there's different conditioned selves. Of course, they're not mutually exclusive. I do get asked, you know, is it only one that I could see myself? You could see yourself, I think, in aspects of different conditioned ways of being. And so the caretaker is one of them, always in care of someone else.
So, okay, so as you say the seven, if you can relate, raise your hand. So what's
one? So really simply a caretaker, always scanning, assessing, looking for someone who is in need of care and then showing up mm-hmm. in care of that person.
And so wait, with the caretaker, how does that, if that is your conditioned self, how does that show up as an adult in love?
So as an adult, typically you probably are doing the same in your relationships. You might, I mean, some of us even become the role of the caretaker, right? Where we go into a field where we are in care of other people, or others exist more in our personal relationships where you're the friend who's, you know, always showing up in service of the other friends. Or a lot of times this comes up with in parenting a lot, right? We are the caregiver, very objectively so, but we then focus our whole life on caring to our own disservice, to the point where we're almost neglecting ourself in the process. Another conditioned self that I very much relate to is an overachiever, where, as I described earlier, right, this endless collection of all of these letters after my name, right, this drive to achieve.
I'm the underachiever. That's not in your book, but
no, yes, it is.
Oh, is it?
The other side of that is absolutely the underachiever.
Right. Usually, the underachiever and the overachiever get together probably because the yin and yang. But anyway,
well, interesting point. I mean, you're bringing up something too, which is thinking of our dynamics within our families and siblings. A lot of times these roles kind of separate out based on what the whole system needed. And a lot of times in families you do see a sibling, if you will, that's more of the achievement driven one, the golden child, I think some people call it in theory. And then you very much see the underachiever, or sometimes people call it like a scapegoat type of personality. And again, I think dynamically it's interesting to think about our own family systems. In a relationship, Joe, the overachiever likes to, again, be achievement-driven, not have needs, right? Be the super partner, you know? Other side of that, the underachiever keeps himself to the background, keeps their needs kind of beneath the surface, doesn't like to cause any waves. What is that? Three, another conditioned self is what I call a yes person, kind of like the ultimate people pleaser, right? Kind of defers to the world around us, never has a say. Again, all in childhood, that likely was adaptive. Similarly in your relationships, right? Just yesing everyone, chronically people-pleasing, very conflict-avoidant a lot of times, that personality. How many other? The rescuer-protector. Thank you for that one. Yes, absolutely. This person, similar to the caretaker, though, I think a rescuer-protector is kind of looking for the emotional vulnerability. Sometimes it's not even directly, you know, kind of tending to the emotionally vulnerable in our relationships. Sometimes we tend to causes, you know, that represent the emotionally vulnerable, because there's a vulnerable part of us, of course, that we are advocating for in those moments.
Do you think the rescuer, this is a generalization, a lot found in the Al-Anon meetings, meaning rescuing people from addiction, trying to save people that can attend?
I think rescuers, yes, we can maybe call them something more common, enabling. I think this is a really interesting dynamic to consider, and it is often a dynamic that's very alive and well in substance abusive or in relationships where individuals are using substances, or really any other dysfunctional habit, where we have the tendency to enable that. On the surface, we think we're helping the person, right? Getting them out of trouble, giving them shelter if they're, you know, using something, though in reality, we might be enabling the habit to continue. And again, that's coming from our desire to help. And I want to normalize all of these conditioned selves, because it's not to say that caring for another person is problematic, right? I don't want people to hear that caring for another person is problematic, or that sometimes taking the back seat to someone else in the underachiever circumstances problematic, or that advocating for those that are vulnerable. I mean, I think that some people are very passionate and purposeful about that. So it's not to say that the actions are necessarily, we can't give them the label of bad or dysfunctional. The issue becomes when we embody this personality to our own detriment, right? When we become this person and when it's against what we want or what we need. So I think that's an important conversation just to kind of embed in this, that we're not to say, because I truly believe that we are all wired to connect and want to serve and be compassionate and, you know, and with another person. So I don't think that, you know, on the surface, any of these actions are bad, but are we doing this to our own detriment? Are we showing up as this role when we would be better benefited by authentically sharing what it is that we want it or need it?
Question yeah, about course. That. So overachiever, overfunctioner, underachiever, underfunctioner, right? What I'm going to relate to it personally, because I'm wondering if you've seen this, you know, in your work as well. What I find for myself and some of my clients is like I overfunction in the stuff, but I underfunction in the emotional side. So I embody both of these kind of archetypes, right? It just depends on what we're talking about. And I think sometimes, I mean, I know we all know this, pop psychology can be very, with a lack of nuance, right? And so people are like, oh, I'm this, I'm that, I'm an anxious attached, I'm an avoidant, you know, without really thinking about, well, maybe in this relationship, I'm more anxious. Maybe in this relationship, I'm more avoidant. And so anyway, I'm just wondering what your thoughts are on this idea of like that over under showing up in different places.
I appreciate you bringing up this nuance and distinction and very much relating to it similarly, right? Me over-functioning in terms of what I can do in service of someone else within the relationship. But if ever a moment where I'm the one in need, it feels very vulnerable to even share my need, let alone receive the support or whatever it is that I could benefit from in that moment. So yes, I really appreciate you kind of offering all of these different nuances in terms of not only relational type, where we could see different aspects of these ways of being, but even around certain contextual aspects of a relationship. And when I give things, like, I'm always kind of two minds. While I know categorizing and giving labels and coming up with conditioned selves and giving people a way to kind of archetypally identify themselves can be of great value. It gives us language. It gives us understanding. For some of us, it gives us a roadmap forward with what to do. Though the other side of my mind in those moments, and anytime I'm writing content or writing books, I don't ever want people to kind of use these as, you know, the be all end all. And I do see this a lot with especially attachment styles, right? Where we
put yourself in a box,
try to put ourselves in the box and desperately even push ourselves in a box that doesn't fit. And I think sometimes the conversation I'm really having right now or musing about is identity. And I do think that kind of categorizing ourselves can benefit in terms of self-awareness, self-understanding, which I always believe is the first step to change. We have to become aware of what we're doing, what's happening, what our pattern is, what our conditioned way of being is before we can make new choices to embody something new. And so I think that it can be really helpful, but I think identities can also be really containing if we are stuffing ourselves in a box that doesn't fit or if we can't kind of see our way into that nuance.
Isn't that the double-edged sword with social media, is that you have a platform to share your story, and it's a beautiful thing. There's no more wall, right? At the same time, well, cancel culture, but also people putting labels on you, putting you in a box. And then on top of that, expecting you to, okay, well, because of this or because of that, you should now speak about this. You should now do this. And if you don't, you have a responsibility, like that kind of stuff. There's a lot of that happening.
Yes. And I think it's natural. I mean, if we just want to talk about really generally why our mind, the human mind, categorizes. Well, first of all, they all do it. All of our mind does that. Naturally, we categorize because simply we just have access to an overwhelming amount of stimuli in any given moment. So the more our mind is able to say, oh, these things go together and this is why they go together. And then we're able to make a snap judgment. Because we are always, again, that evolutionary desire and need to survive in dependent relationship with someone else, our drive to survive, is always there. So simply this kind of act of categorization is our subconscious mind driven by our nervous system's best attempt at survival, right? Because if I can make a split second decision based on what I think I'm seeing in this person,
I'm more calm.
And if it's possibly something threatening that I'm seeing, then I am that much quicker able to find my way to the safety that I need.
Yeah.
So I do want to, again, normalize why our mind does categorize and compare, though, to speak to your very wise point, the other side of that sometimes is we miscategorize, right? We see or we project attributes onto something that we think we see based on the fact that maybe it kind of occurred or co-occurred in other occasions, but we then limit ourselves from seeing the possibility that might not apply
right
here.
Right. What is heart consciousness? And this is really interesting. The heart can predict future events. The woo-woo side in me is very curious about that.
The woo-woo side in me, too, is always fascinated as I started to hear and kind of dip my toe into learning about this whole kind of energetic universe. Because, again, of two minds, I always found it really fascinating and alluring. And the scientist in me really wanted to discover, you know, the evidence of this. And then there was a part of me that felt like it was really fantastical and wild. And like, what do you mean that this we have this like extrasensory energetic system and we're an energetic being? And
what's your take on manifestation? I know, Francesca, that's a big thing that you do with breath work. What is your take on it? Do you believe in it?
I think manifestation is a commonly misunderstood concept.
Yeah.
I think a lot of people think that manifestation is, right, think our way into, if you think you know about something you want desperately enough, before you know it, you create it. When we're missing, very interestingly enough, I think very emblematic of where our field came from, you're missing the foundational piece of that, which, again, in my opinion, is grounded in the body or the embodiment of the actions that take us from step A, right, thinking about the thing that we want, and then becoming the person who actions in the direction of the thing that we want. And I think manifestation very much highlights the reality of the energetic universe, right? If in our energetic system, right, we are beginning to show up in the energy state of someone that is a match for whatever it is that we're, you know, imagining or fantasizing about that we want, then we do increase, it's even going back to what you're saying, becoming the attraction point.
Yeah.
Then we increase the likelihood of attracting the thing that we want. Though I think it speaks to the reality that many of us have maybe experience ourselves, where we have tried to affirm or like mantra our way or think our way.
Yeah, but then do nothing.
The thing that we want. And then when it doesn't happen, right, we say, oh, this is woo woo, this is crap, this is, you know, fantastical, unbelievable. And exactly, it didn't work for me, without seeing all of the ways that maybe we were embodying an energy that was in opposition or even self sabotaging the thing that we wanted to create.
So can I share a quick story?
Yeah.
And it's actually something I'm experiencing in my body in real time. 6 or 7 years ago, before I even met Vanessa, or maybe it was when we first met, I was renting an apartment in Los Feliz, and I got on Dax Shepard's Armchair Expert. And I remember driving there on my motorcycle, and it was like, you know, it was like my David Letterman moment, his big podcast. And went into his, you know, state, and then I went into the attic. You had our interview. He came out with just like a robe and coffee. And I remember leaving thinking, that's what I want. I want to be able to have a studio in my house. And I want to have honest conversations. And I'm not in a robe, but I want coffee.
No, I'm sure you would look great in one.
And I just want to walk out of my house and meet cool people and have, you know. And I want my friends to be there. And I want it to be fun. And that was the imprint leaving that I kind of put, attacked on my forehead. And so I had no idea we'd moved to Altadena. But 6 years later, whether it was conscious or not, one of the reasons why I tried to do these is I'm giving my body the experience that it's already here. So when I feel like we want something, there's a, oh, we're not enough, there's a lacking, there's a desperation. I feel like the magnet flips. If you start to believe, it may not look the way that, you know, I don't have as many toys as him, but like and I didn't know it would look like this. I didn't know I'd be in Altadena, but here I am, right? Like a very, I would say famous, high profile guest having a conversation. My friends are here. We're having coffee, donuts. Like, this is exactly what I wanted. You know?
What more could you want, really?
Well, if I didn't actually acknowledge it, it would skip. I would still be like, oh, when this happens, you know, when I get the mansion, when I get the gated, you know. But I think many people forget there are things happening that we're not aware of because it's right under our nose. We're not paying attention to it, you know.
I love this. I think a lot of us wait to feel a certain way, whether it's motivated or in the embodiment of where we want to go, before we get going. Or before we allow ourselves. And I also want to say something too, because I believe the reality for a lot of us, I don't know how many of us will relate in this room, is what sabotages most of us is the very universal core belief that I think we all share, which is at our core, we don't believe to some extent that we're fully worthy. And I'll even map this onto this developmental timeline. If in childhood, in that state of dependency, as our mind is trying to make sense of whatever's happening or not happening around us, especially around the needs that we have, we can't zoom out and have all these beautiful conversations about nuance and distinction and understand that there's a multitude of factors, including our caregiver's earliest environments, beginning in utero with their caretaker, right, that impact how they show up. We don't have that developmental maturity. So the only way from birth until around age 7 that our mind can even attempt to make sense of the happenings around us is through what is called an egocentric or an us-based perspective system, where the whole world revolves around us. So when a caregiver isn't showing up the way that we need them to, the only meaning that our mind will land on is, well, it must be something with us. And then some of us have access to direct or indirectly stated information on what is the problem with us. We're too dramatic. We're not enough of this. Can't we just be more like this person? This type of job is great for you for financial security, just, you know, sharing from my own example. And then so we begin to modify, which is how these conditioned selves get created, in that direction, because at our core, we believe that to be true. We aren't worthy. This aspect of our self-expression isn't welcome here. We don't belong if this is who and how we are expressing ourselves. So we stop. So I think carrying that core belief, as many of us do, filtering the world through that, we don't believe we're enough.
Yeah.
We don't have that sense of worthiness to get started, or we do get started. And until we understand that that subconscious belief is beneath the surface, that ends up being then that point of sabotage for a lot of us.
Yes, we just buy lottery tickets, right? We live on hope. Our fingers are crossed. And so I want to stop here. Any questions, thoughts? Oh, yes.
I have a question, actually. First, thank you for, I guess, touching on the depth of manifestation. I think it's so important. I just posted recently that manifestation really starts with healing your inner child and then subconscious reprogramming, and then you can embody the energy that you want. Otherwise, you're blocked.
Tell us all the story that you had when she had the thing you have in your phone with the 200,000 followers just to...
Oh, yeah. I think it was like 4 years ago I came across her Instagram page, and it was like getting a master's in psychology. I took a screenshot. I posted it on my story. I said, this is the most important account on the internet. And that was at 200K. And now she's, I think, 6 million plus. And then I said, could you please write a book one day so she could consolidate all of this into reading for us?
You manifested this?
I manifested this.
Yeah, we're here now talking to her.
You said, I'm working on it. But I want to go back to, we were just kind of talking a little bit about the difference between this book and your last book. And I feel like the evolution towards opening your heart and energetics and you kind of touching a little bit more on that and educating all of us along that journey. I'm just more curious about what that was like for you to go from being heavily scientific to then exploring the energy work side.
I appreciate it, because even going back to the question you asked me earlier about the heart, I learned about the power of the heart logically, scientifically, as a scientist.
Oh.
Right? Oh my gosh, this heart, it you know, like our nervous system is sending out signals, is signaling and sensing the environment around us. Wow, here's the science that as individuals, we impact the world around us, right? Then I continued down that rabbit hole, and thanks to HeartMath and all of, I think, the groundbreaking research they do, now I'm, oh my gosh, the heart, a different organ, has an even greater power, right? Scientifically, I was like, wow, this is so cool. Here's this.
Of some bullet points.
So really,
most people
simply,
don't know.
Our body, again, we are sending out energy, you know, at all times, and we are receiving energy from the environment around us at all times. And so if we just think of all of these little kind of energetic waves, the waves, the electromagnetic waves coming from our heart, they've been able to study it, reach a greater distance than the energetic waves coming or initiated by our nervous system, which means that we're all sitting around here and all of our hearts are communicating with other people. So a really common, simple example of this is, I think many of us have lived this experience. We walk into a room of just like this sensor that we have, and we can feel, even if no one's speaking and nothing looks amiss, we can feel if there was just a terrible argument in that room, right? Doesn't have to be even yelling, or we didn't hear any of that. We just walk in and the tension, you could... Right? What is it saying? Cut it with a knife.
Yeah.
Right? And that's just a quick example. Similarly, you can walk into a room and feel like it's something joyful, the lightness that just happened. So that's just a quick example of this sensory system and our heart. So kind of going back to and then becoming the embodiment of heart. So in addition to this sensing and signaling that our heart does, our heart plays a really foundational role in coordinating all of the physiological systems of our body, which simply means our heart, right, is sending messages to our mind and is sending messages, all this energy, right, is sending messages to all of the other organs in our body. And when our heart rhythm is coherent, it's in its normal rhythm, it's not having a stress experience, it's not elevated, we're actually healthier. Physiologically, we're healthier. Our immune system is more resilient. Our nervous system is more resilient. We're better able to deal with stress, which simply means we can become dysregulated and upset, and we can find our way back into peace and calm.
How do we exercise that heart so that vibration is, I'm assuming, Jeff doesn't have a heart, but most of us, how do you, because I'm assuming like a muscle, you have to exercise it, right? Because I know when I was unhappy and I used to be a miserable, I never even focused on heart or energy. It was very, I lived very logically, yes. You know, yeah.
And that was a discovery I had. So the scientist in me was like, wow, heart important. Wow, human Nicole, you are really still disconnected. Because I was really still disconnected from my body, because what was in my body was all of these stressful and overwhelming emotions, dysregulating emotions that I didn't yet have the somatic or body-based tools to deal with. Because the reality of it is stress and emotions are physiological experiences in our body, right? A lot of times activating our nervous system. And until we have that resilience in our body, again, taught in childhood with those hypothetically attuned caregivers, who in the moment of upset were able to come calm and ground it and quite literally bring our nervous system back to calm. So discovering that just affirmed my continued journey in terms of continuing to reconnect with my body, and at the same time to be able to reconnect with my body and feel safe to do so, I had to make sure that I was caring for my nervous system and I was creating and developing the resilience or the ability to tolerate more and more stress, so that I could be more and more grounded and connected in a calm, safe, and secure body. So then it became a foundational daily commitment for me, which begins, especially in busy seasons like this, top of mind every morning, where I have to keep my physical self-care as a priority, because the overachiever in me, with all that neurobiologically, all of those patterns still wired into me, doesn't go away just because I can sit up here and say, oh, that self isn't helpful. You know, each and every morning, I'm still met with endless to-do lists, concerns and worries about all the things that I need to be showing up for, that's for someone else and not me. And so that daily commitment of making sure that I'm tending to myself through consistent daily habits, making sure that I'm continuing to build that resilience in my nervous system, will allow me then more and more time to be with my heart, to tune in to the deeper sensations and emotions outside of just I'm stressed and upset, and really get clarity.
You know, as I'm listening to you, I'm wanting to hashtag this as everything our parents didn't do, you know. but it also, it gives me empathy because, you know, my parents, all they cared about was, because they came to this country with like $500, two kids, didn't speak the language, you know, started in Georgia, lots of racism, took a VW, Volkswagen, drove it to California, and then, you know, made egg rolls and burgers and just surviving, right? And so, I mean, who even thinks of, I mean, this was even a thing, like for people like that to even think about nervous system or self-care, or I mean, they're just trying to pay bills.
There was parenting experts, I don't know the exact decade, I want to say maybe until like the 70s or 80s, who, as the expert in parenting, very much adopted a behavioristic or very much like an animal training model of parenting. There was never conversations about children with emotional needs or what emotional attunement is, and the fact that it is initiated by the ability of our nervous system to be in attunement with someone else. I mean, we legit had parenting experts putting out books saying, oh no, you just reward the behavior that you want to continue and you punish the behavior that you want to go away. And that is how we parent. In addition to, of course, the lack of resources, a lot of our parents were immigrants moving to a new country. In addition to all of the structural issues that we still deal with in our country, and the lack then of resources, information does translate to a lot our parents weren't able to utilize. Even if they gained some know-better along the way, they were so ill-equipped in their own bodies to be able to create the change that they really wanted to make.
Yeah, I think that's how you deploy empathy, is then you are not, they were not monsters, you know? Like, no. They didn't know how to ride the bike, you know? Fortunately, we are popping wheelies and taking jumps and all that. Hey, I wanted to ask Jeff something because he's the only man in the room. So just a snapshot of Jeff. Yesterday I was working out and he pulled his pants down while I was working out and put his butt in my face, right? So that's locker true. Room, very, very, but he's the only guy that shows up to all my stuff. And I really applaud him as a man who is an athlete, locker room, you know, we could chest bump and stuff like that. But then is thirsty for these kind of conversations. And so what does it feel like to be surrounded by women? Yeah, well, this might be a dream for you. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like I'm used to it. I grew up with, she just leaned over and said it, like, I grew up with a single mom. So, you know, my background was like, I had a single mom. All her friends were women. All of her friends' kids, they were all daughters. So it was kind of like, that's just sort of what I grew up around. And yeah, I remember, and I've said this before, and even on our podcast, like, I remember when I was 4, I asked for a Malibu Barbie dream house. My mom was like, we got to get you in sports. Like, I need like a male role model or something, like, you know, around you. Which you actually had a comment about that before, which I kind of forget what it was, but I think it was more like, should have maybe gone a little more the direction of, not enabling, but
I think your mom was trying to protect you.
Yeah, protect me, and also, like,
and also, but also that shames you at the same time.
Yeah, a little bit, but also like sort of like you know, like curating that feminine side a little bit. Where and then afterwards, from like 4 years old on into college, that's like when I always played sports. And he's right, like I'm definitely had that like shove my butt in his face while he's rowing, kind of like sense of humor. But I also have this like, you know, go home and watch Gilmore Girls and Gossip Girl and like that side to me as well. But to me, that's always kind of been like a superpower, I guess, in a way where it's like, I think because it's the way I grew up and I've kind of always like, even from a very young age, have always been around a lot of women where it was like, it never was weird. It never felt weird. It was always like ridiculed by my friends. But then at the same time, like, you know, I would get them into these shows and have them watch these things and these movies. They're like, oh, this is actually really good. I really like this. I'm like, I told you, you know?
Using him as kind of a demographic, I want people like him / men to read more about this. And right now, I don't feel like a lot, maybe turning the corner, but I would assume mostly women are buying these books, not men. Or is it changing?
It's changing. Honestly, John, the past several years in the kind of general, you know, social media community, as well as in my membership self-healer circle, the percentage has been continuing of men. And some of it, I think, is as I've expanded the social media reach across certain platforms. I think certain platforms are more demographically focused in terms of gender. And I think X, you know, being on Twitter or X now, you know, has really kind of increased, though. Yes, still, I think, more predominantly female, but I am seeing just more and more at my events, too, more and more men interested in these conversations, even outside of being in a relationship where their partner's like, hey, you know, or dragging them, like, of their own accord coming. And again, I just think it's so hopeful. And it's just a constant reminder that, yes, while, of course, there's different kind of spheres of influence, if you will, depending on the body that we're born into and the way that kind of we feel, you know, best represent it. Though I think at our core, and I speak to this often, there's so much more similarity in our struggles. Even that example of, right, how many moments where we did have a parent who was showing up and saying something that on the surface was in protection, right? Maybe something that was even similar to what they experienced, and they want to avoid us having that same pain. So something is said with an attempt to protect, though on the other side of that, I thought that was so brilliant in terms of then the shaming aspect of that. So I just think that there's so much similar. And I think that was evident to me when I started to share this content on social media, just seeing the resonance from outside of even, you know, Philadelphia, where I was living at the time, universal, outside of, you know, genders and culture, there was so many more people just saying, yes, at its core, I relate to this experience.
Jeff, since you have the mic, do you have a question about this topic or anything?
Not really, actually.
Danae?
I have a question.
Oh, okay. Oh, yeah, and then Danae.
Sorry. Okay, so I'm a parent. I have 2 kids. And I have, like, been making such an attempt to be aware of, this, you know, information and being a conscious parent, but there's also a lot of pressure that I feel because, you know, I want to break the patterns and I don't want to repeat what I experienced from my parents. So I'm feeling that pressure, but then also having two completely different kids with completely different personalities that need completely different things at completely different times and trying to attune to both of them, but then also they are out of tune with their nervous systems with each other. And so just like how to, you know, and taking the time for myself to try and stay regulated, but there's some days where it's just that dysregulation fires in. It's like, where did that come from? But do you have any, just maybe advice or guidance for parents who are, you know, trying to do this work and trying to show up as their best, but also with multiple children and life situations?
I first want to celebrate you, every parent out there, every parent in this room, every parent listening, because parents, I do think, are very ill-equipped. They are under-resourced. They don't have information. A lot don't have even support within their own homes and communities to even access. And I think a lot about just our ancestry and evolution as humanity in general and how kind of disconnected this is from how it used to be, where there was support. There was the village around us. Kind of that was the model of parenting, of family, of structure. So I want to celebrate. And I even want to acknowledge, even hearing your, what might have just sounded really kind of like a simple statement, you saying, I have two uniquely different kids, right? How for some parents, that's a big shift. I think parenting is one of those places where we assume this similarity or familiarity, right, with this person. Oh, well, they're just like me because they look like me. So now they're going to act like me and be like me. And right. And then we kind of divide, oh, well, if this one kid's like me, then this other kid must be like you. If there are two co-parents, and we lose the individuality. And that's what childhood is all about. Not only, of course, getting the child's needs met to sustain life, so that ultimately the child can learn how to meet their needs, but it's a period of exploration, of curiosity for a parent to even say, oh, I understand that you are different. Let me get to know and help you get to know yourself in this way. So celebrating, I think, ourselves as parents who are doing the work to shift. And I think another expectation that parents put on themselves is as they gain awareness to this information, they put an expectation that change can happen immediately. And that if it doesn't, it's something shameful. Like we've done wrong or bad by our children if we fall back into those old habits, which is why I'm the first person, like I even just shared a couple of minutes ago, my old habits are still there. And I still habitually react in those old ways quite often. I can say and do things I don't mean. I can detach from people that I want to be connected to in that moment, all when I'm not feeling safe and grounded or secure. So those moments parenting where I imagine, right, your challenge, your resources are low, you're trying to care for yourself and these children around you and, you know, keep food on the table and make sure that bills are paid and every other thing. So of course, there's going to be moments where there's yelling, you're saying things maybe that you don't mean, or you're disconnecting from your child when they want or need your attention. So when we put an expectation of perfection, I think that we're not only doing ourselves a disservice, I think we're doing our children one, because we're not showing them the reality of the human experience. And I think that's one area where parents...
Oh, showing them your struggle.
Showing them struggle, verbalizing it, right? Coming back and giving that moment of repair and saying, hey, you know what? I said something really, you know, loud and mean. And maybe, how was that for you? Was that scary? You know, and then understanding from the child's perspective, we think somehow that that's giving our kids a wrong message. That even having an emotion, some parents, I've heard kind of them attest, oh, emotions are for the bedroom, not for in front of my children.
Is that a result of course correcting from our parents, where them showing struggle was, I wish you were never born? You know, like, are we trying to be so not that now we're like muting ourselves or we can't yell or we're terrified we're going to fuck up our kids? Like, you know,
I think
hypersensitive.
Yeah, I think some of it's that. I think some of it is a lack of awareness in terms of what kids are capable of tolerating, understanding. I do think we have this idea that children are much less capable than they are, right? And we kind of, and it's not to say that, of course, some things developmentally can be modified in terms of how things are talked about and developmental language used, but I do think it can be very much an overcompensation without an awareness of what kids can understand and would be helpful for them to understand. Because again, their mind is going to make sense, just like I described earlier. and try to make sense of what's happening, even if you don't tell them. Their nervous system and their heart is going to be attuned to the fact that there is conflict in the other room. Even if you think you're being really quiet about it, they're going to have the experience of you being reactive because you're under-resourced and your nervous system is going back in the habitual reaction mode that it always does. So without the language, without you telling them a different alternative version, their mind, especially if they're young children, will assume responsibility.
And I feel like just the fact that you're aware of this already right. makes you a good exactly. parent. You know what I'm saying?
Yes.
Yeah.
100%.
Instead of focusing on the execution piece, just the fact that it's on, you're thinking about yes. this is huge. I saw something on the internet where it said Gen Z, we were raised on hose water and neglect.
Gen X.
Gen X. Gen X, not Gen Z. I'm Gen X. Right. Yeah, you got, Gen Z is like kombucha but hose water and neglect. I was like, oh yeah, that was my child.
Well, that was interesting for me to reckon with because I wouldn't have resonated and like heard someone say neglect and said, yes, I had a version of that too, because I always had the physically present caregiver. My mom was in care of the home and in care of me and was always there and there was always food on my table. So I would have never applied a label such as neglect to the experience that I had had. And I write about that in my first book, How to Do the Work, where I was overtaken. I'm reading a book about an emotionally absent mother. I think I'm doing, research for my clients who have that kind of mom, not me. And before I know it, I'm in near hysterics. And just to be clear, when that was happening, I didn't have this narrative. I wasn't like, oh, well, Nicole, you're crying because you're very much relating to this experience. I was like, why are you crying? You're a mess. What's going on with you? And the tears were coming, again, and this is a beautiful illustration, from that subconscious knowing that is what I experienced. Of no ill intention of my mom, in a lot of ways, she broke a lot of habits. I mean, she came from a childhood where her father didn't even talk to the children. He would go to work, he would put up the paper in front of them and just delete the children from their existence. So it's not to say that I was neglected to that extent. Absolutely not. I had very much interactions with my mom. She was there able to celebrate me when I was succeeding. She wanted the best for me. Though in reality, I did have the experience of emotional neglect, not because she was mean, because she didn't have the resources to even be with herself emotionally, because that childhood impacted her. She was left equally alone, overwhelmed, and this is how cycles happen, right? Under-resourced. So she adapted, and the way she adapted was to disconnect and become so emotionally distanced from even herself. How could she ever have an emotionally attuned relationship with her children? And then I carried that same patterning. I blamed every partner I picked, determining that they just can't meet me and my emotional needs, and I'll just go on and find the person who can, until really I started to take a hard look at, well, what is the common denominator here? Why am I always feeling so alone no matter who I'm with? And then began my journey of seeing all the ways that this was patterned into me from that emotional neglect of childhood.
Today?
Yeah, I feel like you're starting to speak about what I was going to ask you, Nicole. And something I've loved so much about your work for a while is I feel like you are such a pioneering force in challenging the status quo on how we hold things. And certainly this book and what you're talking about is challenging something that I, as primarily a couples therapist, have felt challenged by in the different orientations of couples therapy and how we hold what it is to love one another. And what I often experience as the instruction that we should be reparenting one another, and a lot of conversation around co-regulation. And what I love about what you're speaking to in terms of energy is that what I started to see as I was sitting with couples is how much there was like a competing for energy thing happening, right? And if I can just get you to fill me up with the energy that I am lacking, then I will feel complete and whole. And in doing that, we were really acting in some unloving ways, right? And there's this thing that you also were talking about when one person is sort of the like overachiever that becomes the other person as an underachiever. And that's been normalized. But I think in Jungian psychology, they would say that that's sort of like your inferior functions not getting the opportunity to develop. And so I'm asking all of this because I'm curious, as we do some of this work of really coming into a little bit more like, it's not your job to fill me up, that's my job. I am supposed to come into that state of like understanding my self-worth and my wholeness. How do you see relationships evolving and developing if I'm not looking for you to complete me? Like, what does that look like? Do you know what I mean?
I love this question because I think sometimes when people kind of hear, you know, this idea of it isn't someone's responsibility to complete us, to care for us, to make us feel any kind of way, I think understandably then the question is, well, why are we in relationships? What's the point, right? If there isn't any, right? So that's not to say that there isn't a valuable function of comfort, of safety, of security, of support that we can gain in relationships. And I love what you're describing of this kind of competition, energetic competition, because while I can affirm, right, that, you know, relationships, there's this energetic exchange, giving and receiving support, giving and receiving trust and comfort and everything that I just described, I think sometimes we kind of lose timeline focus. I don't know how I exactly want to say this. We look for the immediate equalization of energy, right? You're going to do this for me. Okay, well, then I'm going to do this for you immediately, if not sooner. And then when those scales don't immediately feel equal, then I think we start to engage in this kind of desperate, direct and indirect, sometimes demanding of what we want or what we need. Even we're not directly saying it, I think it's an energy that can be felt. We can feel when someone's kind of pulling or needing or wanting something of us energetically. So how do I think relationships will expand and shift? I think as we begin to take ownership for the role that we're playing in a relationship in terms of our ability to even give and receive support, which back to the analogy, I think that we all love to hate, the putting our air mask on first, right? Making sure, again, that there is space for us in a relationship to care for our body and our nervous system so that we can be in that regulated state to have resources to give, then I think what will happen for relationships is you will open up an opportunity to feel truly and authentically attuned and connected, to be able to exchange support. And I think we'll be able to shift out of that immediacy need for it. We'll be able to understand that because we are energetic creatures, there are different seasons. And I've even had the experience of this in my relationship where I've gone through periods of time where I don't have much to be giving. Even some my partners that I love and want to give and support and give love and, you know, objective, you know, things that I could do to help support them or whatever it is that they're struggling with. And whether it was around the death of my mom now a little over 2 years ago, where I was just so emotionally in grief that I couldn't care for anyone else's emotions, whether it's around even opportunities like this, putting out a new book. And energetically, right, I'm giving a lot of service. I'm, you know, wanting to be on and, you know, in my flow and in my zone, which means that I have a little less to give to other people. Now, that doesn't mean, right, being able to, I think, enter into this more dynamic relationship, we have space for that now, right? My partners now understand that that doesn't mean that I'll never be able to come back and give them the support that they need, but they're able to kind of delay their need for it. And I think that's just going to be another byproduct. Not only will we create more space for not only individual evolution, relational evolution, I think we'll be able to move into a system where individuals are able to feel that easeful exchange of energy and not have to feel like they need to receive it back, or they're not, it's not equal, or this isn't the partner for us.
I feel like, Danae, you may want to punch me in the face, but the good news is we all can disagree about things. We're not, you know, and still allow space to see other sides. I mean, that's how we grow, right? A thought I had real quick was, why can't we be more like trees where we physically see the change of seasons, where it's like, can't you see I have no leaves right now? Like, fucking, right? Connect with me when I'm nothing. Orange and in fall. I think, so this whole idea of not having needs, I do agree with, where all the foundational needs, the need to feel valuable, feel worthy, that's our responsibility, that's our dream, something we definitely need to work on. So we're contributing a whole person to that equation of the relationship. But I do believe that what's the point of being in a relationship if there isn't something in exchange as far as something that's shared that you're not getting alone? You know what I'm saying? So I don't know if the word is need. I don't know what that, you know, I'm on that exploration as far as with love. What is a need that you should fulfill that is your responsibility? And what is a legitimate need? You know, there's a need to feel safe. There's a need, you know, is someone remembering your birthday, is that a need? Is that a want? Does that, you know, stuff like that. So I feel like social media and a lot of people right now with the whole oxygen mask, because we are shifting this way, there needs to be a beat for that to happen. But then I feel like after that, it'll swing a little bit more where it is okay to kind of need each other in a way, not be needy, but that's the point of us and what our uniqueness builds, you know?
Yeah, I think, you know, connection, support, knowing that we do have that base to go back to, even if it is an absence of them being able to do anything specifically for us. I think the reality of it is when we're in upset, when we're in a stressful emotion, when we're in suffering, on very limited occasions, do we really need someone to do anything? What we really just want is them to be in presence with us. And I think that is the need. So, but I think what's interesting, John, is what you're talking about. A lot of the reactions we're having, right, are to stories that we're telling ourselves about what events, actions, or inactions mean, right? As opposed to understanding the deeper need. Like, we make things about the dishes being undone when in reality, you know, maybe we're feeling lonely or maybe we are feeling under-supported or unseen in whatever it is that we're dealing with. So it does become about, you know, dishes, but we really have to understand, well, what the dishes mean, what's going on underneath of it. And I think underneath of it, yes, of course, we all have that desire to be belong, to be connected, to know that we're okay and worthy, regardless of how it is that we're feeling. I want to go back to something you said too, because it was really interesting. In terms of, you said something along the lines of like telling, or I don't know exactly what it was, but my thought was, how often do we, oh, the trees, right? Can't we just have some marker where people will know what it is we're feeling, right? My thought was, I think a lot of people think that we are obvious. We are the tree, right? I think a lot of people think we are giving sometimes even very direct signals of what we want. And then we're aghast when someone isn't picking up what we're throwing down. You know what I mean? And I'll be the first to say, you know, and I have a little bit of a passive aggressive streak where I could, you know, say things that I think are super direct in what I want. And I get called out on it all the time. I'm like, do you really just need support right now? Is that why you're saying you wish you had help, Nicole? I'm like, well,
basically, you're saying I have a very dull radar, which is true.
I guess I am, you know. Yeah, yeah. But I think,
but you can see you're saying
there's something important in there, though, because we do project, right, this obviousness about ourselves. We project people to be a mind reader, that they should just be able to, the right person would just be so attuned to us they would know. And I think we then overstep or bypass the step of just directly communicating. We aren't as clear. We aren't the tree that we think we are. People might not even be paying as much attention to our signals in the way that we would like them to, and or they're going to be projecting onto us their truth, right? So they might be seeing you in some particular display of action or whatever it is, and they might be familiar to them in a different way, right? What you might be sensing that you're signaling might be a different message, put it that way, that they're receiving. But we assume, we do all these assumptions, we hold them responsible, and now we're mad, and now we're in this whole tizzy about something that wasn't as clear for the other person. So I think sometimes getting clear, directly communicating, which might mean getting curious and clear about what our need is, because sometimes we don't know, and we just expect and assume and hope other people will figure it out for us. Until we directly know, and then until we're able to vulnerably directly share with someone, risking the possibility that they might not want to or be able to show up in service, right? Back to this idea of energy exchange, might not mean that they don't love us or aren't caring and compassionate and the relationship isn't a priority. Might just mean that they too don't have resources in this moment. And then we risk the disappointment and the reality that they might not be able to show up for us, but we were directly in communication, increasing the likelihood that they are able to hear us and they are able to meet our need.
So this is something I think with doing men's work, this is something a lot of men need to me included. Me at 50, I'm kind of trying to learn more about attunement and reading someone, not based on what they say, but their energy. With Vanessa, the first time in my life. And so I'm definitely a late bloomer at that, but I feel like this is really important in relationships. Because I don't know if it's something that a lot of men even think about or work on or practice. And so there's a huge disconnect because men are all about, well, you didn't say it. You didn't say it. So, you know what I'm saying? Instead of, well, can't you read? It's like, oh, you should have just told me, that kind of thing. So it's important. Thank you for asking that, because that was a great segue into how I wanted to end this. By the way, this is your jam. Any questions, thoughts, revelations?
No.
All your stuff is nervous system. Her whole page, which is great. Yeah. The book is amazing. The epilogue, which is how I want to end this. So I was done reading the book, and then I read the epilogue. I usually don't, but I read it, and I was like, oh, wow, she's dropping something that's very vulnerable and personal. And I was like, this is amazing. So in the epilogue, you talk about how, for the first time in your life, you're involved in, I'm going to say truffle. I know it's a type of chocolate. That's not what it's called. Jeff, shut up. What is it called? A thruffle?
Thruffle.
Why? It's such a weird. The fuck is, can we just call it a truffle? It's beautiful. Chocolate, sweet.
My wife's mom calls it a trollop.
Don't worry, that was a man. Don't roll your eyes at me. Leave the toxic That's masculinity outside of the. You should give me a hug instead of rolling your eyes at me. You are involved in a thruffle. How do you say it? English is my second language. Okay, whatever. You have multiple partners. Okay, which is also very right now kind of the topic with, you know, non-monogamy and, you know, customizing your relationship. This is all brand new. All, like, I'm in my life, and I gotta say, in my 20s and 30s and maybe even 40s, I'd be like, you guys are fucking nuts. Now at 50, I'm like, oh, some of it makes sense. And I'm very curious about all this. So can you tell me the pros and cons and what has been, like, your revelations with this? Why are you laughing?
Can I build on this question? Because this is going to be my question, too.
Yes.
I'm curious, in the context of the energy and the needs conversation, like, is this the time where we get to reorient the models for our needs or for capacity, that we have a certain relationship with someone and we recognize they don't have capacity to meet me in that need? So I get to open up the forum for inviting another relationship into my life, however it's defined, to meet me in that way, while also knowing that I'm meeting myself, right? And don't we get to redefine that? And do you feel like we're in the precipice both of redefining the model, but also rethinking the priority of which relationships we focus on most, right? So familial relationships or an intimate partner, like, we can also get a lot of needs met from friendships. So it feels like these are all, it's like a portfolio of options potentially that we have to think about, right? Yeah. Isn't that so healthy?
Not for some people, but yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that honestly is my hope for sharing. And this is outside of even updating the model of romantic relationship. I would just like us to first explore what our model of relationship is, right? Understanding a lot of it did come from not only our childhood experiences, but our culture and things that we were taught and learned, and whether it's from movies or, you know, just our belief system and religion and everything that kind of defines and goes into that, so that we can then create space for personal exploration and for possible modification or expansion. Because what I have seen and done myself, back to this idea of even categorizing, like we were talking about earlier, I do believe we have an idea or even a relationship model. Like, if I were to say friend, you might all just think of, like, a vision of a prototypical what friend means to you. For some of you, it might be what you do together, how you feel, the type of person, right? The butt in the face, right? That's what a friend is. Puts my butt. But, right, so, and then I would imagine you would kind of throw all your friends in that bucket, right? Well, so that's who I look for to be my friend, someone who checks those boxes, because that's what a friend is. And then, of course, we do that for romantic partnership and family. And I even love this idea of prioritization. Culture plays a big role, right? Who gets the top rung? Is it the family of origin? Is it the new family that I'm creating, right? Who gets the priority? And I go, there's a lot of messaging in there. But I do think we do tend to categorize and then limit ourselves from seeing the possibility that we might have a whole spectrum of friendships, right? I can have one friendship who really gets me emotionally. We are just so attuned, and that's kind of the landscape of what we do together, right? We talk about our emotions. We can have another friendship who completely doesn't get me at all emotionally. They're on a different planet, but we really like the same shared interests. We hike together, or we do art together, whatever, right? We have the same thing we do. Same thing with romantic relationships. outside of course, and I was hesitant. I was, while I knew I needed to and wanted to, because I speak so much about my own relationship journey in the book, I did want to obviously update in terms of the status of it. My intention never was to suggest that this is the direction for all relationship, though I do think that primary partnerships can be benefited when we do become aware of possibly the expectation that we are putting on one person to be everything, which is so common, right? Once we've developed and created this committed partnership, now this person becomes our completion, our person that we go to through every need. They need to be endlessly available. It doesn't matter what's happening in their world, right? They're my person. And I do think that we limit ourselves from opportunities for different types of connection or for support in the natural moments where the person that we would like to be available for us isn't available for whatever reason, right? And I think the more we can get clear on the current relationship model that we're operating on, the more we can then welcome in possibilities for expansion. And so without having any of this language, I'll be perfectly transparently honest. As the three of us were beginning to talk about feelings and attractions that were happening, so I was in a committed married partnership with my Lolly. I don't want to even call her my primary partner, primary by first, met her longest ago, because we don't have the way our relationship operates. There's not, while some relationships operate in like a hierarchical structure, right, with primaries and secondaries, we very much consider it the three of us. Though Lolly and I had spent time together, a relationship together for the longest time. And then Jenna came into our life professionally within the community, started to build the circle membership out with us, spent a lot of time personally. We were living in proximity of each other in Venice Beach. And over the course of that kind of year plus of spending time together, feelings were starting to develop for Lolly and I, much more outside of our awareness. Weren't really letting ourselves, just speaking from my own experience, I wouldn't have let myself truly entertain the possibility of saying, hey, I'm interested in this other person, because I was already in like multiple, yeah, romance, expanded multiple partnerships. I knew people had were in those. I never was myself. So I wouldn't have even entertained. I wouldn't have even really let, I didn't really even let that attraction come up into a thought that I would even do anything with, because it was just so, well, that's not appropriate. That's not, what would that mean about Lolly and I then, right? If I like, and this is, I think, another avenue we go down. Well, I can't be attracted or like someone else or interested in even developing a bond or connection, because that takes away from my attraction or like of the initial person I'm with. I believe there's an infinite capacity.
Yeah, because that means love is limited. There's only so much in this cup.
Exactly. So again, saying that to say, when the attractions were finally starting to be brought out into the open, for which I'm grateful for Jenna, is the person who, very heart-driven, heart-led individual, which is one of the, I think, points of attraction to even begin working together. She was almost the complete opposite of me in life experience and journey to get here. I mean, she is someone who, the scientist in me, is trying to logic my way through life, and she just, her heart is pulling her wherever her heart goes, right? And I'm like, oh my gosh, you know, are you sure this isn't logical? This isn't going to get you, you know? And but that point of attraction, really the benefit being, she was the first person who was like, I'm going to be vulnerable and I'm going to say what it is for me. And the gift of that then was allowing myself to be really honest, you know, I was like, oh, interesting.
Did she say, I am starting to have feelings, I love both of you?
Both of
or
you.
Did she like 30% here? Said like,
both.
This is what I like about you.
Yes.
This is what it's
called. Yes. It was very much, we were approached both separately, Lolly and I, though the conversation was, yes, both of us.
And,
you know, over time spent together, that she was just, you know, there was an attraction and interest. And she was even blindsided, never been in this type of relationship before, had no idea how we were even going to react with her sharing. I mean, here we are working together too, which I know is a whole other aspect, like complicated nature. What I do know is the three of us are so purposeful and passionate about the work we do that the conversation was had in the context of, hey, something's not working, because communication started to break down. It started to be a lot of conflicts about dishes, put it that way. You know what I mean? Or like little things. And so it started to be like the three of us were needing to address it in the direction of, we need to figure out what's going on so we can work together. Because we were really clear that the work we were doing was in such purpose for all three of us that we didn't want to impact that relationship, though we knew we had to talk about what was happening because it was impacting. So really the crossroads at that point was either, Jenna, I'm going to share this with the two of you because there is interest in the two of you, And we're either going to maybe openly explore what this could mean, or I'm going to share this with you. It's going to be out in the open, right? We could now allow this to be the reality. And then we might have to have a professional discussion around new boundaries. Maybe we're spending a little too much time together. You know, maybe we need to separate a little bit so that, you know, she could, you know, kind of process her feelings and, you know, find and create a relationship. But lo and behold, there was interest. And so I was joking to say about throuple. We did what I think a lot of us do is I went online to make sure it was a valid thing to do. Are other people doing this? Can no. I do this?
Right. Yeah, man. You researched it.
Is anyone else doing this? Yeah. I mean, natural, right? Because this was so new.
Yeah.
For
how
me.
Long ago was this?
This was a little over 2 years ago now, yeah. I think it was exactly.
Which is not that
yes,
long
it was.
Ago.
It was a little, it was right before my mom died. And because that time, those several months was just complete overhaul in life in a lot of ways for me. So it was, yes, a little over 2 years ago now was that conversation. So being validated that, yes, people do enter into three-person relationship. They are called throuples. Because again, now we are exploring, well, what are we doing? You know, are we just like opening our relationship up, Lolly and I? You know, I really wanted Lolly to explore this if she was interested in it, committed to her evolution. I knew I wanted to explore it. Like, are we doing this with other people too? Is it just Jenna? Right? It's all this. So our version of it was, again, this, we were going to explore the possibility, because we didn't know what would end up happening, of whether or not we could be in a three-person, live and work in a three-person committed relationship, which then brings us to the question at hand, which is the dynamics, the energy, the endless opportunities to heal. Because again, I'm really in, back to this idea of expanded relationship. I have two different relationships with each of them separately because they are two different individuals. I relate to them differently. I connect with them differently. We simply do separate things of interest together. Then there is, of course, the relationship as a whole. There's the way that they challenge me separately. There's the natural challenge and insecurity and jealousy of observing attention and love and go elsewhere when maybe I want it or need it in any given moment, or even just comparing. What does your connection look like? Why don't you do this with me? So endless opportunity of challenge, of growth, of awareness, and, you know, a lot of moments of difficulty, of challenge. I would lie if I said, oh, no. It's like someone I heard describe, well, in reference to this conversation, someone, I think it was kind of referenced, well, you guys are so emotionally mature. It must not be an issue for you at all. Not necessarily. There are a lot of moments where, you know, we're human. Resources are lacking. We are trying to build a business and work together. We are going through our own, you know, different layers of our own evolutionary journey. And when you do have two people that, you know, are there in interaction, a lot can come up.
Do you like this better for you right now? Or is it like it's an evolution and I don't have a choice, meaning I'm leaning into what's presented in my life?
I feel as in, like, will this continue?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I think that, again, you know, my hope is that it continues, the three of us, and we are able to continue to build, you know, this secure base of partnership. And yes, it feels very fulfilling to me.
Yeah.
It feels like it is speaking to and allowing a part of my self-expression that I hadn't really been able to be in full contact with. And I just really love the exercise in embracing my desire that this is allowed for me, because something I have done, whether it's in my perspectives or my emotions or my wants, I've watered myself down in such fear of the impact that it would have on someone else. And especially in an area like, you know, desire, you know, who am I to want something? I could just turn that off because my want could hurt someone that I love and care about. So for me, giving myself the possibility of having space to honor my want and allowing that to be okay, and even giving myself the lived experience of it not necessarily hurting or crumbling the relationship, but making it stronger, is outside of obviously moments of challenge that I'm describing. I think generally, though, that's just been such a gift that I can kind of live the experience of having both, of having space for me and not having it immediately be at the expense of, if that makes sense.
I want to applaud you for, is that an Amazon truck? Oh,
electric FedEx.
Yeah, on my podcast, there's always parrots, FedEx trucks. They're just part of the whole thing, part of the whole experience. I want to end with by applauding your courage to show yourself in that way as a leader and also someone who, you know, where the spotlight is always on you. You could have definitely kept that personal. But for me, it encourages me to be transparent. Like, you know, like if she is doing that, why can't I share my story as well, kind of thing. So, and I'm sure you're doing that for millions. So thank you for sharing that.
Of course.
You know, it's a very hot topic these days.
Yeah. And I share it too with I do put the disclaimer in the epilogue that this isn't me sharing it to, you know, suggest. But I do hope the teaching in that is some version of giving all of the readers, all of you in here, the possibility of or opportunity to hit pause and look at the many moments where you do kind of instinctually have a feeling on your heart, have a want, have a desire, and where you are maybe censoring that or suppressing that for whatever reason. And whether or not you choose to express the thing or not, but just giving you that pause and that moment of empowered choice, right, where you're able to decide for yourself if it's something that you want to vulnerably share with whomever or not. Because I know that there are probably a million moments that we can all kind of call to mind where, you know, instinctually there was the thing that for whatever reason we didn't say or do. And my hope is that it gives people like yourself, John, the permission to just hit that pause and to be a more conscious participant in what it is that they express instead of just keeping that lid on just like I did, because, well, this isn't something that I would ever, you know, this isn't something that I entertain or a person like me, or what would that mean? What people think? How will she feel? Right? Just giving yourself a moment to be in maybe that exploration before you decide whether or not you're going to express the thing.
Well, thank you for being here.
Oh, gosh. Thank you for having
me. Yeah.
Thank you all for being here. This was really great. I think I might only come on live podcast from now on. It's life-giving.
Well, I mean, we're on
Zoom. I don't love all the other podcasts.
We're on Zoom so much. Yeah, this is such a great idea because it's fun.
Yeah.
And, you know, like, because we're always behind screens, you know, so.
The energy is just, you can really feel it's palpable.